Good morning and welcome to Shattering Mess. I am Yara. Each weekday morning here on GCN, I strive to expose the destructive and also the deadly myths which are associated with religion and with politics, with patriotism and with the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission here on Shattering Myths is to help you understand what is occurring behind these headlines and how these events will shape our world over the next 10, 15, and 20 years. Then during our second hour, we engage God on His terms. We consider His covenant and turn to His always dependable Torah teaching so that with His guidance, all of us can replace any vestiges of religion that still cling to our souls with reason and engage in a relationship with Him. Our phone number for those who would like to participate in our discussion is 877-300-7645. I was reading this morning a number of articles that were written regarding Margaret Thatcher, who died yesterday in Great Britain. We mentioned it briefly during yesterday's show. She was, of course, known as the Iron Lady, and that is the moniker that will be her primary legacy. It is interesting that Margaret Thatcher came to power during a time that Britain was rapidly declining economically. Britain was leading Europe into the abyss economically. Every aspect of the country's economy was in shambles. It wasn't much different than when Ronald Reagan came to power in the United States. If you remember the Carter years where inflation was extraordinarily high in the mid-teens. Inflation was very high. So interest rates in the mid-teens, inflation in the mid-teens. We were in a recession. Joblessness was extremely high. Reagan used to combine the inflation index, which is a measure of how rapidly government is stealing your savings, with interest rates being high, which cripple business opportunity, and he called it a misery index, if you'll recall. Well, that was the time that Margaret Thatcher came to power. She had a much more focused view of how to resolve the problem than did Reagan. Reagan's issue was just get government off people's back, which is a right thing to do, lower taxes so that people can actually invest and spend and keep more of their own money because government squanders it, as opposed to individuals are much more likely to invest it wisely and take care of their future and their retirement and the like. And that was Reagan's strategy. It worked marvelously in America. America grew economically. The tide raised most all boats economically in the country. Reagan, of course, made the mistake of at the same time trying to hugely add to America's military, and by trying to increase the size of the military by very large percent, he spent far more than he took in, even though his lower tax rates, the Laffer curve was correct. When you lower tax rates, which are too high on business and on the most successful wage earners, you actually receive more revenue, not less revenue. But he unfortunately was not a conservative spender. He was a big spender. Margaret Thatcher was a bit more consistent in her economic policy. She was the longest-serving British prime minister, and her entire mantra was free market capitalism, the very same thing that has led the rapid expansion that we have seen in China. You know, in China, the government is communist, but the economic system is free enterprise. And the same kind of growth that we're witnessing in China, she managed to take Great Britain out of the doldrums. She was also extraordinarily opposed to the integration of Europe. She did not like the sentiment of the Eurozone and the Euro, and fought to keep Great Britain as the one major country in Europe that would not participate in the euro. And now that you witness, we witness the decline of the eurozone and the draconian measures that it's applying on member states, we can see the wisdom in what she attempted to do. Barack Obama, who is the antithesis of Margaret Thatcher, I mean, everything that Barack Obama stands for, Margaret Thatcher opposed, but duplicitous as ever, Obama said the world lost one of the great champions of freedom and liberty, and America lost a true friend. The reality is that the reason that freedom and liberty were enhanced in Great Britain is because Margaret Thatcher was opposed to socialism. She was opposed to large government control systems, and she was in favor of individual responsibility and opportunity. Now, what's interesting in Great Britain is about half of the country, I would say a lot less than half of the country, actually, is celebrating this woman's legacy because, to a great extent, she saved her country. It was she saved it now for a short period of time. It was dying. She revived it. It is dying once again. But she did save her country for a short period of time. But she saved her country by doing the opposite of what Barack Obama, for example, is doing. She opposed unions. She recognized that unions were counterproductive to the people's interest overall because they were destructive of business and of freedom of working opportunities. And so she opposed unions, knew that unions were extraordinarily destructive to the economy as a whole. And she was far more interested in creating a vibrant economy where there were opportunities to work so that if you wanted to work, if you were capable of working, you could work, as opposed to simply doling out money and food and housing and the like to people who had not earned it, did not deserve it, because that creates, as we have seen, a permanent impoverished class who is wholly dependent on government. Now, socialists like that because that's their power base. Those people vote to get more of other people's money, and they reelect liberal politicians. But Margaret Thatcher was opposed to it. She did things that were so radical for her time. You know, with public housing for the homeless, she came up with a way that those who were living in those housing projects had the opportunity to buy them over a long period of time, and that if they owned them, they would take better care of them, show some pride in them, and that's precisely what happened. Now, as it relates to those on the side of the majority today, which is let's go ahead and have class warfare. Let's have the 1% give up everything that they have earned and lavish it on the 50% that don't want to work. A guy like, here's this article, Carl Chamberlain. He's 45 years old. He said, "We've waited a long time for her death, sporting a gray ponytail and sipping a can of alcoholic cider in Brixton, London." He said that he loathed her. He didn't want to work. Thatcher had her opponents. For example, one newspaper says she is the woman who saved Britain. The Daily Mail across town says that she is the woman who divided a nation. The question being, did she actually do more for the poor by creating opportunities so that the poor would no longer be poor, so they'd have the opportunity and ability to work in an economy that was vibrant? Or was it better for the poor to provide them with a safety net and to have entitlements of all kinds? Cutting taxes, liberalizing exchange controls, privatizing the state-controlled businesses. Thatcher transformed Britain's economy and helped strengthen the city of London into a global financial center that was only challenged by New York. her strategy worked. What has been put in its place, what preceded it, what has followed it, has failed, which is socialism. Margaret Thatcher is gone, but hear what the unions have to say. The unions hated her. Well, the unions love, of course, Barack Obama. Margaret Thatcher is gone, but the damage caused by her fatally flawed policies linger on. The National Union of Mine Workers said Thatcher's virtually destroyed our union during year-long strikes. Good riddance. I found her to be confrontational, dogmatic, and abrasive. She attacked people in her own country and didn't listen to people in her own party. She's still destructive and nihilistic. You know, the reality is that if you have character, if you're properly exercising good judgment, you are going to be confrontational. Those people who are not confrontational, who are compromising and who just give people what they want, that those are the people without character. Those are the people who lead nations into their own destruction. Margaret Thatcher had a backbone. Now, I only met the woman once, had a opportunity to get to know her, but not certainly not intimately. And she was just a woman who knew what was the right thing to do and didn't care if you didn't agree. She was going to stick to her guns. Now, she did some stupid things. She sided with Bush when he decided to start the first Gulf War. That was foolish. She was way too into Ronald Reagan's evil empire with the Soviet Union. She engaged in the war in the Falklands. I mean, there were aspects of her time in office that weren't glorious. But economically, she got it. It was a, if you want to look at the benefit of lowering taxes, of not lowering taxes on to the extent that we have in America, where 50% of Americans no longer pay any tax, at least federal income tax. They pay other kinds of taxes, Social Security taxes, and the like. But if you want to see what happens, if on business, for example, and the most prolific wage earners, if you lower tax on them, and if you remove government restrictions, and you privatize what were public institutions, if you want to see what happens, look at the Margaret Thatcher years. England was dying. She was restored. Now that the policies have been rebuked, she is dying again. To Shattering Myths. Yesterday we were just beginning to cover a story about how a federal judge in Alexandria, just outside of Washington, D.C., this judge's name is T.S. Ellis III, threw out the case of Khalid al-Masri's, where he was seeking an apology and financial damages for the abuse that was perpetrated on him by the CIA. And this is such an important story, I didn't want to just leave it with a cursory mention. Yesterday, the last part of the story that we covered was that the federal judge threw out the case of a German citizen. Yes, Khalid al-Masri is a German citizen. His government, Germany, has conducted a thorough investigation of his claims, as has Macedonia, which is where Khalid was kidnapped. And his claims have also been investigated by the International Court, which, by the way, I'm not much of a fan of. But in this case, all three investigative bodies came to the same conclusion, which is that the CIA did kidnap this man, did wrongfully hold him as a hostage without any due process, without any court, without the opportunity to defend himself for 5 months. And while he was held, they routinely tortured him. They sodomized him. They did unspeakable acts to this man over the period of 5 months, and then they dumped him out in a gully beside a street, I think in Algeria, after having kidnapped him in Macedonia where he was on vacation. Now, the federal judge, this T.S. Elias III, has thrown out the case because it poses a grave risk of damage to national security by exposing government secrets. Now, what government secret is going to be exposed? That the CIA kidnaps individuals in other countries, which is a breach of international law and breach of any kind of civil ethics? Is it that secret that's going to damage national security? Is it the reality that the CIA, even though it denies doing so, tortures? Is it the reality that the CIA is as demented as are the most barbaric cause-driven idiots out in the world, and that their forms of torture are absolutely barbaric? They sodomize this man. I mean, is that the government secret that will damage national security? Is the fact that the United States is not what it claims to be? It claims to be a nation of laws, a nation of that is just, a nation that affords rights to everyone. Well, it's not that nation anymore. And is this judge, has he come to the point where he realizes that as someone who is dependent on the government paying his salary and giving him a position of power, that if the truth about the U.S. government being a hypocrite, being exactly what they say they oppose, will that damage national security because that secret is so corrosive to patriotism, to the myths of politics, the mythology that Americans have? You know, Americans view themselves extraordinarily arrogantly, as if they were the freest nation on earth, and yet America incarcerates a higher percentage of its people than any nation on earth. There are more Americans in jail than in any other country in the world. America touts itself as being the economic powerhouse of the world. But actually, America is the most in debt nation in the world. There's no one even close to America in terms of aggregate debt. We're the most broke country in the world. America touts itself as the great manufacturing engine of the world. Then it was passed like it was standing still. In fact, it was passed like it was going backwards not too long ago by China. You know, we talk about being the most moral nation in the world, and yet we kidnap people and sodomize them. We are the world's largest consumer of recreational narcotics. I mean, the hell that is being perpetrated in Mexico with the drug lords is because of America's fallen morality, that things are so bad we drug ourselves. You know, I was looking at the unemployment numbers the other day, and 2 days ago it was announced that unemployment fell to 7.8%. And so, wow, that looks pretty low compared to Europe. But in the same article, even the Los Angeles Times took the Obama administration to task, and it revealed the reason that unemployment fell, which was that during the same month, hundreds of thousands of Americans who are unemployed gave up even looking for work. When we come back to Shattering Myths, we'll not only continue this story on the man that the CIA sodomized, but also what percentage of Americans are actually unemployed. Well, welcome back to Shattering Myths, the answer to the question that I asked at the end of the program. You know, the government is reporting 7.8% unemployment. Well, unemployment is reasonably and rationally defined as the percentage of those who are of working age, since if you're too young, it's illegal for you to work. If you're too old, it's difficult for you to work. Working age is typically defined as 20 to 55. And so it would be the percentage of those of working age who can work, who don't have a physical or mental or a health-related issue which would preclude them from being able to work. So the percentage of Americans who are not working but are of the age where they're able to work and are of a physical condition where they are able to work is not 7.8%. It is 45%. 55% of Americans who are of working age and are able to work are working. 45% are not. So it is this hypocrisy, it's this myth that permeates Americans' mindset that is driven by propaganda and patriotism that is the very thing that this district judge, T.S. Ellis III, is trying to protect. He acknowledged that Khalid al-Marsi has suffered injury. The investigations that were done by Germany, Macedonia, and the European criminal system has demonstrated that his story is accurate. And the judge says, yes, he deserves a remedy. However, you're not going to find justice in the American judicial system. He said that it would be a grave risk if the information pertaining to his case were made public. Marcy was held by the CIA for 5 months, kidnapped and then detained, incarcerated by the U.S. government for 5 months. Now, kidnapping is a crime, and in fact, kidnapping is one of the worst crimes that you can commit. If you're a private citizen and you kidnap somebody and you hold them hostage for 5 months, you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail. But the CIA did it and got away with it. No one even held accountable. He was kidnapped based upon mistaken identity. He was beaten. He was sodomized. He was routinely interrogated because of alleged terrorist ties, none of which were true. But let's just say they were true. What is an Islamic terrorist group? It's a expression of the Islamic religion. Pure and simple. Does the U.S. Constitution say that the free expression of religion shall not be hindered? Now, that's one of our problems, is that our Constitution is actually opposed to our ability to do the right thing. But since the Constitution says that we should not interfere with the free practice of religion, if he was a Islamic terrorist, which he wasn't, what right, based upon the U.S. Constitution, does America have to infringe on their right to practice their religion, particularly since they're practicing their religion elsewhere? Now, I despise religion. And the worst religion on the planet today is Islam. And it is a call to arms. It is a declaration of war against all humankind. But let's at least recognize that it is the religion that is causing this adverse behavior that is so uncivilized that motivates all Muslims to kill. Now, by saying that, what I'm saying is that all Muslims who are motivated to kill are motivated because of Muhammad's examples and Allah's orders. All good Muslims are terrorists. That doesn't mean that every Muslim is a terrorist, but all the good ones are. If you follow Muhammad's example, if you study the Quran and Hadith, if you apply what the wannabe God and wannabe prophet said to your life, you will be like Muhammad. You'll be a rapist. You'll be a kidnapper. You'll be a sodomizer. You will be a rapist. You will be a ruthless terrorist and mass murderer, because that's what Muhammad himself was. And it is his example that they're following. But be that as it may, the U.S. Constitution says, no, you can't incarcerate somebody without due process. You can't punish them without due process. Their rights, they have the rights to a trial. You can't take their liberty or their life. And yet with the drones, we're routinely killing thousands of people around the world. Ellis said that the remedy cannot be found in the U.S. courts. Why? Because the U.S. courts are not a place of justice, obviously. Marcy's private interest must give way to the national interest in preserving state secrets. What secret? I mean, this man was kidnapped. He was sodomized. He was tortured. He was held hostage for 5 months and then dumped out in a gutter. How is that? How is just the CIA saying, yeah, we did it. We ought not have done it. Bad boys. We apologize. How is that in the national interest to preserve that state secret? He dismissed the lawsuit last year against former CIA Director George Tenet and 10 unnamed CIA officials. Marcy has sought an apology and for monetary compensation. The CIA, with all the money laundering they do, why not give him a public apology? Say, we goofed. What we did was wrong. It was reprehensible. Here's some dough and a public apology. But they're not moral enough, not rational enough even to do that. The ruling was a victory for the Justice Department, Department prosecutors who are seeking to create an illusion of a nation that is unlike the real one, who had invoked the once rarely cited state secrets privilege to argue for a dismissal. Created in the 1950s, it allows the government to urge courts to dismiss cases on the grounds of damage to foreign policy or national security. All of Europe knows what happens here. There is no foreign policy issue here other than most European parliaments have now discussed this man's case and said that they will not, cannot tolerate any CIA operations in their country. They will not support or be part of the CIA's kidnapping or torturing. And that any time that somebody is abused in this way, that these countries will do whatever they can to thwart the CIA. It's common knowledge. The privilege has been used far more frequently since the September 2001 quote-unquote terrorist attacks. That weren't a terrorist attack. It was a fundamentalist Islamic group that perpetrated the attack. They were good Muslims. And what did we do? The nation that wishes to control its people, the nation that has economically and as it relates to politics kidnapped and sodomized its own citizenry, used that attack, miscast it, the reason behind it, to declare a war on a tactic whereby they could deprive all Americans of their freedoms and even the ability to know the malfeasance of its government. Judges have acceded to the government's request almost universally. Last year, for example, the government won dismissal of a lawsuit of a Canadian citizen who claimed that he was taken to Syria by U.S. officials for detention and was tortured there. Ben Weitzer, an American Civil Liberties Union defending Marcy, said Ellis was precisely wrong. This is the judge, was precisely wrong that the judicial branch should not be involved here. He said the case was an opportunity to examine the CIA's program of secretly detaining suspects in one country and then moving them to another for interrogation and detention, a process the CIA calls rendition. This is doubly insulting, Wisner said. Everyone knows that Mr. Al-Marcy was a mistaken victim of the rendition program. He is now a victim of the misuse of state secrets privilege. But the government even responded to, the judge wrote, it would compromise intelligence sources and methods. What? Obviously, our intelligence sources and methods are compromised. That's the whole purpose of this case, is to demonstrate that the intelligence sources and methods are compromised. They're grotesquely immoral. They're ineffective. They are counterproductive. They do not represent a civil society. Ellis concluded, such a revelation would present a grave risk of injury to national security. You know, when the truth poses a grave risk of injury to an institution, then that institution is gravely ill. Marcy, a German citizen of Lebanese descent, was arrested by police in Macedonia in December of 2003 because his name was the same as another man suspected of terrorist links and because the Macedonian police believed that he was carrying a false passport, according to the former and current intelligence officials and the U.S. diplomats. He was held for 5 months largely because the head of the CIA's counterintelligence center's Al-Qaeda unit believe that he was somebody else. A former CIA official last year said, on the condition of anonymity, because we don't stand for anything. German investigators have confirmed most all of Morsi's allegations, which have received extensive publicity in Europe. In December, a senior Bush administrator official traveling with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the U.S. officials had told Germans that Morsi was released because the intelligence was insufficient to justify his detention. They are lying to cover up their lies. It is what they do. And now what they're saying is in the United States, we will not be held accountable. Europe took a different view. The United States was tarred and feathered with this, rightfully so. And now that the United States has decided to continue to hide its head in the mud, in its own pigsty, the credibility of this country is weakened once again. America once stood for things that were noble, that were good. She was known for things that were noble and good. She was once envied. Now America is looked upon by the most of for what she has become. And it's no longer good. A suicide bomb exploded in the main business district of Damascus yesterday. It killed 15 people, setting cars ablaze. This is now the United States because it isn't willing to acknowledge that the Muslims who are receiving American weapons are far worse than the Assad regime. So we're providing the means for them to do this. A Damascus resident who was near the blast said that there was bodies and carnage and plumes of smoke everywhere. A score of people were killed. Three scores of people were severely wounded, and the death marked home. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. There is a myth that America liberated Iraq when in fact it gave Iraq to Iran. And in the process of giving Iraq to Iran, there's this myth that the United States prevailed in Iraq because of its awakening councils, because it armed Sunni militants through their warlords so that they could oppose the threat of the Shia militias, since America replaced a secular government in Iraq, one that was more endearing to Sunnis than Shias, with a Shiite government that was controlled by Tehran. The Sunni militias became vastly more vicious and were annihilating Sunnis en masse. And so the United States came up with the idea that we're going to arm Sunni citizens through their warlords, their chieftains, and we're going to call it the Awakening Project. Well, it's that project which ultimately led to the armed conflict in Syria. They were the first to bring arms. They were Sunnis. The government is, while secular in Syria, has far closer ties with Shias than with Sunnis. And so the Sunnis saw it as their opportunity for a more lively jihad, a greater opportunity to end up in Allah's brothel. Well, that's what this next story tells us. It begins by saying that Iraq's al-Qaeda wing. Iraq does not have an al-Qaeda ring. In fact, when we raided bin Laden's lair in Pakistan, what we learned is that the three places where some semblance of the al-Qaeda brand was being deployed in a name, that those who did so were doing so without Osama bin Laden's approval or backing, and that he was extraordinarily hostile to them, that there was no connection between the al-Qaeda that was Osama bin Laden's and these organizations, particularly in Iraq. Osama bin Laden was never deployed al-Qaeda in Iraq because he hated Saddam Hussein. And he realized, however, that if Saddam Hussein was deposed, Shias would take charge of Iraq, which would be counterproductive to him and to al-Qaeda because he's a Sunni. Well, despite all of that, Reuters reports that Iraq's al-Qaeda wing, it isn't al-Qaeda's wing, it's the Islamic Nation of Iraq, has united with a kindred Syrian group in the front line of the struggle to oust President Bashar al-Assad, sharpening a dilemma for nations that back the revolt but fear rising Islamist militancy. The leader of the Islamic State of Iraq, and that's the Sunnis that we empowered as part of the awakening, we tacitly said, you know, one of the things you could also do is you could use these weapons to go after the Islamic State of Iraq, which was the most fundamentalist Mujahideen jihadist movement of Sunnis trying to defend themselves now against these the Shia militias. And what it turned out to be is that they just became one, so that the Islamic State in Iraq is now part and parcel with the awakening. Well, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has said that his group, the Islamic State of Iraq, has funded cells of fighters from Syria's al-Nusra Front. The al-Nusra Front is the largest group of Mujahideen operating in Syria. They're the most brutal. They're the perpetrators of most of the suicide bombings. They are the dominant force, however, in the Syrian rebellion. And so the Islamic State of Iraq, which the United States essentially aided and abetted through its awakenings programs, is now openly acknowledging that it's a partner with Syria's al-Nusra Front. And America considers the Islamic State of Iraq to be an affiliate of al-Qaeda. So now what do you do? He said in his statement posted on his variety of Islamist websites and seen by Reuters on Tuesday that the two groups operate together under the joint title of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. The Levant is the area that Muslims want to have a unified Caliphate that is called the land of Islam. It is now time to declare in front of the people of the Levant and the world that al-Nusra Front is but an extension of the Islamic State of Iraq and is part of it, Baghdadi said. So the Nusra Front, which is the largest group of rebels fighting in Syria, the very group that we are aiding, is actually part of al-Qaeda from America's perspective.
Start life over. Spend more quality time with your family. Take more vacations. Own your own business. Be healthy and earn the kind of income you've always dreamed of. Is it possible? Yes. Yeah.